Get your daily market recap on the latest stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. John Farrell and I are committed to a global stance as we go to the World Cup. And now, representing Denmark, who is in the World Cup, Torsten Slok joins us. He's chief economist at Apollo Global Management. Far more than that, his leadership in economics with Peter Hooper at Deutsche Bank over the years and going over to the dark side. What was the change like going Deutsche Bank to Apollo? I mean, on a given Monday, when you walked in the door at Apollo from a major bank with your major success there, what was that like?
Well, my job is to watch the economic data and watch financial markets. And with that backdrop, that's really the same thing I do.
Same
today.
Old, same old.
Well, talking about inflation, unemployment, the things that you guys talk about, what's going on? Are things getting better? Are they getting worse? Are the central banks going to react differently? The job is really very similar.
Very good. How important is the next inflation data after the festivities we saw yesterday?
I think it's very important because what I think is the key issue at the moment is the sequencing of hitting the Fed's dual mandate. So what that means that is yesterday we got confirmation that we have seen now inflation come down from the peak in June without an increase in the unemployment rate. That's of course telling you that we might actually have a scenario where we could have a soft landing because we are now seeing inflation begin to come down. Admittedly, 7.7 is still very elevated, but at least it's coming down without the feared increase in the unemployment rate because the Fed's dual mandate, and Jay Powell has been very clear about this, we need to see a softening in the labor market, and we have really not seen any meaningful softening. So the sequencing happens to be in the right way for markets, namely first inflation is coming down without even seeing an increase in the unemployment rate.
And let's explore that further. So we may have seen peak inflation year over year. Where does it bottom out at next year?
So obviously there's a very long road. If you compare with what happened in the mid-1970s, it took 2 years in 1974 to get inflation back from the peak to where it was before. So if it also takes 2 years, then of course we still have very long road ahead of us. And that of course could be associated with all kinds of shocks, including of course not only geopolitical shocks, but also to commodity prices and other parts of the CPI complex.
This is hard to predict, of course, but is there something about the nature, the characteristic of this inflation story that means it will be difficult to go back to the low inflation of the previous regime?
Yeah, so there's a number of arguments why you could have inflation potentially higher in the long run. First of all, you have, of course, demographics and immigration that looks quite different now. You had very little immigration during the pandemic, and also the demographics also suggesting that we could have a more permanent upward push on inflation. You also have that deglobalization, that if there is less globalization in the future, that's also going to imply that the stuff that we buy and in stores and that we purchase will, of course, be more expensive. And finally, technology might not be contributing with as much productivity growth as it has done historically. So that is all arguing for that there might be some structural pressures. But it is important that the reason why inflation is high at the moment is probably also very importantly for cyclical reasons. So yes, as you're saying, John, we need to get down with inflation towards two, but it is certainly a long road we have ahead of us.
Do you aggregate your economic analysis, or as you mentioned, technology? Are we now a polarized America, a polarized Denmark, a polarized world of the technology haves and the technology have-nots?
Well, the main implication of that, of course, is what impact it has on inflation. So, of course, one very important debate is when you invest, for example, in renewable energy, that's, of course, very a big debate about is that inflationary or disinflationary? Because all investment, all CapEx spending should be disinflationary. So in that sense, there's some very important differences across the Atlantic Ocean in terms of what is the investment outlook for the U.S. relative to Europe
across the board.
This was
on capital deepening. Dominic Constant at Mizzou has been very good on this. The idea that there's some things going on post-pandemic, supply side, demand side, and all that. But are we seeing a capital deepening that we're, I would say, is invisible almost right now?
Well, at least we're seeing very significant capital deepening in the energy transition. And that's, of course, very important because that's ultimately the goal with that is to lower energy prices, which ultimately should be disinflationary for inflation. But it's true that this is certainly a very important theme also for the long-run outlook for inflation. But I still say that in the near term, the inflation outlook is mainly driven by the cyclical drivers of inflation, namely the risk that the U.S. economy is overheating. And that's, of course, the whole reason why the Fed is raising rates in an attempt to try to cool things down. And they haven't really been very successful at cooling things down. They've cooled down the goods sector or the interest rate sensitive components of GDP, but that's only about 20% of GDP. The service sector, airlines packed, hotels, restaurants, concerts, sporting events, it's all packed everywhere.
The shelter conversation, a big piece of this as well. You mentioned the sequencing. Can you compare and contrast the sequencing you're talking about in America and what you're seeing to what you're also seeing develop in Europe? Because we both sense a different story there.
Yeah, that's very important because in Europe you're actually seeing inflation still going up, but economic activity is starting to slow down. In fact, if you look at your Bloomberg screen, it will see, of course, consensus expects that both Europe and Germany in particular will be in a recession next year. So the conclusion is, of course, that if you have a very different situation in Europe where it's just going to take a little bit longer before you begin to see inflation come down, then it becomes a debate about, well, is it the case that inflation is going to stay higher for longer in the U.S. or in the euro area?
Stagflation in Europe, base case now for you?
At least today, it looks like Europe is facing a lot more headwinds than the U.S. because Europe, unfortunately, is facing inflation that's at a higher levels. There are some very important issues about that. The composition of inflation in Europe consists more of energy. About two-thirds of inflation in Europe is energy and only a third in the U.S. So if energy prices, once we get to the other side of February 2023, once we get to the other side of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the 12-month window will begin to no longer take into account the big spike that we had in energy prices.
The base effects kick in.
And that's exactly when you begin to see European inflation potentially coming down a lot harder. So that's why in the rate space, there's a lot of debate, of course, about are bonds attractive at these levels if European inflation is potentially coming down very, very quickly once we get into the second quarter of next year.
So are you, in summary, an optimistic tone for Apollo management? Are you telling them that transactions can be a benefit now? Or are you telling them to build cash, to use cash, to keep cash?
Well, the way I look at it is that in March of 2020, the window of opportunity, in my view, was only open for about 2 weeks. The window of opportunity for doing things at the moment is probably more like 2 years, maybe even three. In other words, there's a lot of distress. High yield markets are essentially shut down.
Right,
capital
right.
markets are essentially shut down. And that's where private equity and private capital, of course, is playing a very, very important role as stabilizer, stepping in and doing things.
Where's the pain is the question we've been asking around this table. And the price that we're going to pay for 400 basis points of tightening in 8 months, is it really just a 25% move on the S&P, a 30% move on the NASDAQ?
Well, and as you know, the debate about it is long and variable lags. I mean, it's still not clear to me personally what exactly that means. But at this point, you still say, okay, well, where are these long and variable lags? We're now, well, depending on how you look at it, but we're at least 6-9 months into these long and variable lags, and we really haven't seen much impact yet. So absolutely, the pain really here is that if inflation does not come down, the Fed will have to go and potentially go a lot more.
Do you follow Denmark football?
Oh, absolutely. I should have worn my red shirt today.
It's a great story. I mean, this guy, Christian Eriksen, had a heart attack. He's come back, and Denmark has whooped France a number of times.
And
I mean,
one
it's
of
maybe the most exciting pairing
He's
there
such
is.
A classy player.
And he's one of the best players on Manchester United's team, and he plays so well today. I love him. He's great.
I mean, it's just, folks, this is really something. This guy, John, I'm not exaggerating. He literally almost died on the field.
Oh, not at all. That's not an exaggeration at all.
Yeah.
Came very close, and it's great to see him back on a field.
And they're in the bracket with France, who they've already shown they can beat. I mean, is this? That's the one game.
I love how much knowledge you've got on this.
I'm working, folks. I got my cliff notes out.
Torsten, I've been discussing just how much things are going to shut down in Europe on the trading floors. And how much market volume is going to roll over going into Christmas?
Oh, well, Denmark is playing France on a Saturday. This is Thanksgiving Saturday. I'll be out in Williamsburg watching with all my buddies.
Is that what you're going to do?
Absolutely.
Is there a special bar for Denmark in
absolutely.
Williamsburg?
Absolutely. This is the beer garden.
Do we get
beer garden?
Oh, they serve beer. I'm shocked.
Torsten, this was awesome. Thank you, sir. Torsten Slok there of Apollo Management.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
So let's go back to December 24, 2018, one of the greatest calls in equity market strategy, the modern times. Benjamin Laidler of HSBC says, shut up, a bottom's in. He absolutely nailed it with eToro today and their global market strategist. He has published this morning, the bottom is in. Ben Laidler, is this like Christmas Eve of 2018?
Yeah, it is. I do think the bottom's in for a lot of reasons. I think earnings are hanging in there. I think sentiment's very poor. Valuations are low. We've got wild cards like China improving. And now, crucially, the inflation fever is sort of beginning to break, and that's giving us some visibility on the top of the cycle. That's not enough to get us off on the next bull market, but it's absolutely enough to tell us that the bottom's in. So I think, you know, that's a similarity with 2018. The difference is that then it was a V-shaped recovery. This, I think, is going to be more like a U, but this is absolutely the necessary first step. And, you know, we learned a lot of things yesterday. One of them was you've got to be in it to win it. So I do think you know, investors need to be in this market.
Ben, what is the character or the human behavior of those loaded in cash? There's a lot of cash out there right now. I have prospectus portfolios of 5%, 4% who are in 7% cash, et cetera. How will cash respond?
Yeah, tough to criticize that. I mean, it's been a historic year for the failure of diversification. You know, basically nothing's worked apart from cash. So I'm sympathetic, but we're going into the end of the year. Historically, the best seasonality of the year, you can pour cold water on that, you know, many times, but I don't think you can this year after such a historically bad year across all asset classes with so much cash on the sidelines. I'm looking forward to a less bad 2023. I think those are the ingredients for Christmas continuing to come early.
Ben, there were some curious moves yesterday as well. A lot of people picking on, say, a company called Carvana, which operates an online platform for buying used cars, running more than 30% on a CPI print that showed used car prices absolutely plunging. So, Ben, can you help me understand the moves that I should get on the train with and the ones I should avoid?
Yeah, I think that's a reflection of valuation relief, lower bond yields, and just, you know, just how aggressively underweight a lot of people are. So, you know, where do you get the biggest bang for your buck? Where do you get the most leverage? The stuff that collapsed the most, where valuations have been under the most pressure, that's where you saw some relief from yesterday. That doesn't mean you should chase it. I still think, you know, this is a market where you want to be invested, but you want to be reasonably defensive. It's going to be two steps forward, one step back. I mean, we may have seen the peak of inflation, but I do think it's going to be a bumpy sort of march down. So, you know, stay in those defensives, and as we get some more validation that inflation just continues to come down and, you know, we get to the top of that Fed cycle and begin to look to sort of cuts later in 2023, you just keep adding risk. And risk is probably bigger tech and traditional rate sensitives like real estate. I'm not convinced by the sort of disruptive tech names, you know, at this point, even though that's what led the rally yesterday.
Let's talk about leadership. You touched on it. You're calling the Santa rally 2 weeks before Thanksgiving. Christmas has come early. Let's build on that. The tech names that you do want to own, Ben, and where you're starting to be encouraged by some of the work that's being done by the C-suite. We've seen cuts at places like Meta. We saw a report from the Journal yesterday that Amazon was getting in on the cost-cutting act as well. Where do you want to be? Where do you want to avoid?
So I think it's a bit of a barbell. As I say, right now, those traditional sort of value names, I think they continue to do well, right? Both on the defensive, the sort of healthcare names, but also some of these sort of depressed, banks. But I think looking forward, I think next year is going to be very different to this year. This year was all about massive valuation deratings and earnings holding reasonably firm. I think next year is the opposite. I think earnings are going to come under more pressure, and you're going to get some valuation relief. I think that's a much better environment for big tech with these dominant market shares, these big margins, these strong cash flows, fortress balance sheets, and valuations that have already come down a long way.
So Ben, final question then. You're calling for rate cuts in 23. What's behind that call?
Rate cuts at the end of 23. I think markets are going to start discounting that, you know, reasonably early. I think you look at every inflation lead indicator. There's not a single inflation lead indicator that's not meaningfully off its highs at this point. Across housing, labor markets, car prices, inflation expectations, commodity prices. I think that's going to continue to move in our direction through 2023. That's going to take a lot of the pressure off the Fed. I think the question is, how quickly do we get those rate cuts? I think we're looking for an extended pause. As long as inflation numbers keep drifting down, I think the market's going to start discounting cuts later in 2023, reasonably early.
A better week for Ben Laidler of eToro. Ben, thank you, sir, as always.
This is a joy, and we did not set ourselves up with a massive market move to have in the studios Elsa Lignos, Global Head of Foreign Exchange Strategy at the Royal Bank of Canada, RBC. She attends from Europe, where she is definitive on the linkage of ECB dynamics with the foreign exchange market. Let's start right there, because I've had a real dearth of euro analysis. What is your call on euro, given the last 24 hours play?
So it's a really interesting moment and actually slightly painful for me because I went long euro dollar a couple of weeks ago, got stopped on a little move lower, and now pretty neutral and watching this rally. But I think yesterday's CPI actually gave a lot of people a green light to do something they wanted to do already. For me, what was striking was listening to our head of spot in Europe and our head of spot in North America ahead of the number, talking about what they were going to do. I've got to say, the difference in opinion between Europe and the US is incredible.
What shaped it?
People in Europe really think we're near the end, right? And they've been waiting to play that, and this CPI was kind of hanging over them. I think even if we'd had an inline number, we would have seen people selling USD.
Is that because the news has been better in Europe relative to expectations? What is it?
Not at all. I think people are just so itching to see the end of this Fed hiking cycle. And maybe there's just more doom and gloom. Maybe there's just more pessimism about the state of the US economy than I think you feel here, right here in New York City. But it's the difference in opinion between Europe and the US at the moment, I think, is the biggest I've ever seen.
You mentioned earlier you were stopped out, which is jargon for some people. You set up a trade. You believe in stronger euro. It comes back. You're forced out of your trade, essentially, and you're on the sidelines. How much of the market is on the sidelines for this weak dollar moment?
Exactly. I think there'll be a lot of people in that position. And heading into year end, people who've had an incredibly strong performance on the back of being long dollars are now scrambling, thinking, OK, do I take it off? I had a lot of conviction in this trade. Mm-hmm. A lot of people I spoke to earlier in the week were convinced we go higher in 2023. And I think there's a lot of FOMO in the market right now. People, whether in the equity market or in the fixed income market, trying to get.
How does FOMO express itself in foreign exchange? I think our viewers and listeners are like, really? What's our lunch is longer in London when that happens?
You know, more than anything, it's the fact that FX is so liquid, you can put on big positions quickly. And I think it might be an easier way for a lot of people to reposition their portfolios. Hence, we've seen the
interesting.
Size of the
move.
You did that at Claridge's a couple of years ago.
I wish.
Were at lunch at Claridge's.
I wish.
Boom, you put on that sterling trade.
How would you reset this morning?
So look, the trade I've been looking at, which I actually really like, is across long euro sterling. So buying the euro, selling the pound. Not because I'm from the UK and just very gloomy about our prospects, but I think you've kind of got to strip the dollar out of the equation at the moment. We still have another CPI print before the December FOMC. We had a bit of a head fake earlier this year, August, September CPI. So I've got to be honest, it's a great move if you caught it. And had I been in 2 weeks ago, I would be riding it now. today, I think it's a little harder to buy euro dollar at these levels. I like long euro stuff.
So is that a positioning story? Is that fundamentals on the euro side? You said it wasn't just pessimism on the sterling side. What is it?
So what I find really interesting is all the investors I speak to, nobody's actually positive on the euro. People might be bullish euro dollar because they're bearish on the US dollar, but nobody's positive on the euro. And it's not that I think cyclically Europe is looking great. A lot of people worry about 2023 and the winter there, how we're going to get through with gas inventories. Mm-hmm. What I think is really interesting is European investors potentially repatriating money back home. And if we start to see that in size, you could get a lot of euro buying from that domestic shift in assets.
Where's the EM trade right now? Where's the opportunity for a number of big figures profit in the EM?
Well, you touched on crude earlier, Tom, and I think we're seeing some really interesting moves in commodity markets. And the commodity
Whoa, wait. Stop. What she's saying there, folks, is she has Halima Croft to help her out here. Link Elsa and Halima together. On the Halima Croft oil trade, what do you do in foreign exchange?
Exactly. So we really like the Mexican peso, have liked it all year. Still think that has a bit further to run. Brazil's tricky at the moment, given the finance minister.
In the World Cup. I mean, Brazil's a real uncertainty in the World Cup.
Well, drum roll. Let's do the World Cup right now. The heartbeat of foreign exchange worldwide, City of London. What on earth is going to happen to volumes in London in a couple of weeks? Off the cliff?
You know, heading into Christmas, it always gets a little bit quieter.
Imagine how much worse it's going to get.
Well, we'll have to wait and see.
TK, nuts.
Dollar Mexico, 20. I remember when it was a barometer for American politics.
Sure.
19.43. How many big figures can you make here, strong Mexico?
Well, I think what's interesting about Mexico is really the carry that you pick up. And mm-hmm. I think that's why a lot of people have bought it. It's not so much the spot move, but it's the fact that you get that very mm-hmm. positive real yield, particularly if we're now pricing in lower yields for the U.S.
I know you've been traveling, but we'd be thrilled to have you in Doha for our World Cup coverage.
Wouldn't
as
we
well
love that?
When we go
have
there.
We got that sponsored yet? Is RBC going to sponsor
RBC,
that?
I think, is all over it as well.
That Halima's,
oh, here's Halima calling right now.
And Laurie Cavacina's dialed in too.
Yeah, she could, you know, we could do an
wonderful.
RBC.
Thank you. Brilliant team at RBC.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
That is the same with Tina Fordham, founder and geopolitical strategist, Fordham Global Foresight, with some serious abilities, including support of the University of Cambridge foreign policy effort. Why is she on? It's real simple. Tina Fordham wrote a blistering op-ed in the Financial Times about the future of America. Tina, you dare say, use parenthetically from a removed distance the phrase civil war, but what you say is this could be a take no prisoners Congress. What do you mean that a Republican Congress will be take no prisoners?
Well, that's me trying to be diplomatic, Tom. But in this blistering, as you called it, op-ed piece for the FT Alphaville, what I really wanted to do was poke a little bit at particularly U.S. investors' complacency about a divided Congress being kind of reflexively a good thing. We had Elon Musk coming out and saying that, and people resorting to what I consider some pretty sloppy shortcuts in our thinking when the Republic, as we know it, really faces some serious pressures. Now, my piece came out the day of the midterms, and since then, the less qualified contingent, shall we say, they call this candidate quality, in fact, in the parlance, didn't perform very well. And I think a lot of those with fire in their bellies have been somewhat chastened, but we still have a number of underlying mm-hmm. indicators in the U.S., support for political violence, you know, the polarization that we've all just sort of got used to, that are alarming. But right. I think that there were some real reasons for optimism coming out, too.
The arrogance, the political arrogance led by Tom Keene, is that we're a two-party system. We have learned in the last couple days that we're a four-party system of extremists and two moderate parties. Do you agree with that, that it's a four-party America?
Well, our structure is built for a two-party system, but within each of those parties, we have contingents which make coming to any kind of agreement on anything extremely difficult. Now, the so-called MAGA Republicans didn't do as well as hoped, but they're still hugely influential. And I suppose what I'm thinking about the most right now, because it's that time of year when we have to do the year ahead outlook, is who's going to run America, and from where I sit here in London and in Europe, what does that mean for the future of the international system? Trump is less likely to return to the White House. I can tell you that people here really breathed a sigh of relief, but the race is wide open, and that, you know, that is a new variable, I suppose, one that we hadn't really got our heads around.
Well, Tina, let's turn to the G20 and talk about the international story. The president with some renewed confidence, some people might say, after this week. How do you think that's going to play out next week?
Well, Biden is entitled, I think, to have a bit of swagger in his step. I know that's an unfashionable thing to say, but, you know, I'm all about providing an analytical framework. The president's party normally gets hammered in midterms, and Democrats performed better than anybody thought. Personally, I'm not excited about the fact that we have such an elderly leadership. I think a gerontocracy for a country that's still quite young is worrying. But when Biden goes to the G20, Putin is going to be there by Zoom. I think that's remarkable, change from a few months ago when we were talking about, you know, with genuine concern, whether Beijing's announcement in February of a friendship without limits with Russia was going to be a major change to the weights in the international system. China is not using any of its global political capital to help Russia. Russia finds itself marginalized, and when we look at these kind of big macro dynamics, India also has, you know, not hesitated to be critical, to use its vote at the UN, and Saudi, which had aligned with Russia, or at least that's how it was perceived at OPEC, seems to be trying to kind of adjust there. So, you know, we're looking at a shift in the planetary weights in the global solar system, and a much more marginalized role for Russia, which has been a spoiler really since the collapse of the Soviet Union, or since Putin came to power in 2000.
Tina, briefly, if you can, we understand now it's been confirmed, a meeting between the President of the United States and the Chinese leader on Monday ahead of the G20. We often talk about deliverables. Are there any going into this?
I don't think we should expect deliverables. This is a time, you know, I've just talked about some of the tensions in the relationship. Biden goes not as somebody who, you know, was defeated in midterms, but as someone who I think intends to run again. He has clout. And the U.S. and China on climate, and particularly, it was an area of cooperation. So I think they're going to want to find a bottom to, you know, this relationship, you know, find a floor and move on from there. China's not happy about the U.S. cramping its style on tech.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the U.S. has stood its ground in a way that commands more respect on the world stage, particularly after the fiasco, the withdrawal in Afghanistan, right? That was a huge blow.
Tina, thank you. Tina Fordham there of Fordham Global Foresight.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.